Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Okay, welcome back. Today, we have a very special episode for all of you, and that is the case, because I am going to be talking about my top 24 movies of 2024. 2024 was a very strong movie for was a very strong year for movies overall, and it is time for me to give you my thoughts on what I think are the absolute best movies that year had to offer. Now, I will begin this episode by discussing some ground rules. What movies am I including, and you know, what does a movie need to do in order for it to be eligible for this list? And those ground rules are: first of all, I am not counting short films. Second of all, I am not counting documentary films, even though I did see some absolutely exceptional documentaries this year, in particular No Other Land, Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, and Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. All three of those documentaries are truly incredible, and I couldn't recommend it enough, but I'm not going to be including them for this list. I'm only focusing on narrative feature-length movies. And the last rule that the movies need to follow in order for them to be, you know, in order for them to be able to be on this list, is they need to say that they were released in 2024 in either IMDb or Letterboxd. Considering that, there are some great movies that I watched this year in 2024 that were widely released and were widely available in 2024 that unfortunately are not going to be on this list, because technically it says, and they are registered as being released in 2023. These are movies like His Three Daughters and Sing Sing, both two movies that I very much loved and would otherwise be on this list, but once again, according to my rules, they were released in 2023, so I'm not including them in this video. Now, without further ado, let's jump into my honorable mentions, which are numbers 24 to 11. So, at number 24, the 24th best movie I saw in 2024 was Deadpool and Wolverine. And what can I say? I just thought this movie was a lot of fun, and generally one of the most fun cinematic experiences I had all year. I love how this film feels like a love letter to old Marvel movies. You know, we saw Blade, we saw Gambit, we saw X-23 from the Logan movie, we saw Elektra. It was just such a beautiful love letter to all of those films that I have a lot of nostalgia to, but it is not only that, but I also thought this was a movie with a lot of heart. It is not a perfect movie, but in all honesty, in a post-Endgame Marvel Cinematic Universe, where most movies have been, in my opinion, quite frankly, mediocre, Deadpool and Wolverine stands like a breath of fresh air, and it is one that I very much enjoy. Now, on number 23, the next movie that I would like to highlight is Saturday Night. Now, let me just make sure. Yes, okay, perfect. Now, at number 23, the next movie that I would like to highlight is Saturday Night. Now, this is a movie that I already talked about in my video about everything that I watched at VIFF, and this is a movie that I found to be extremely energetic and chaotic in the best way possible. I am not an SNL fan, but even I was drawn in by the world, by the characters, and by the passion and determination of all of these people in order to try to achieve their goal. Then, at number 22, I have Civil War by Alex Garland. I am a big Alex Garland fan. I'm a big fan of his films. I love Ex Machina. I think Annihilation is great, and I even respect and find a lot to enjoy in Men. This movie felt like his version of Come and See and Apocalypse Now. That is something that I very much enjoy. It has some great, very intense moments, and I think one of the things that I love the most about this movie is that it feels like a Rorschach test, and depending on where you fall in the political spectrum, you might very well read this movie in a completely different way. Now, in order for this film to be a Rorschach test in that sense of the way, I do think the movie sacrificed world building in order to be able to do so. It was intentionally vague, and you know, that is the only reason why it's not higher up on this list, but Civil War is a movie that I very much enjoy. Now, moving on, at number 21, I have Suleiman's Story. This was a movie that I had no idea what it was about. I had no idea it even existed until I watched it at this year's VIFF, at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival, and I absolutely loved it. As I said in my video about everything that I watched at VIFF, I thought this movie felt like a modern day retelling of Bicycle Thieves in a thematic way, I guess I would say. It is an extremely realistic, raw portrayal of, you know, African immigrants and what they endure when they arrive in Europe. And I just thought this movie was very, very solid. Then, at number 20th, I actually have September 5. Now, September 5, it follows this broadcasting crew that is at the 1972 Munich Olympics in order to broadcast, you know, the Olympics, the sport. But they end up having to broadcast the hostage crisis that happened in that year's Olympics. I thought this movie was really, really great. It is not really a movie that is interested in discussing politics and discussing the geopolitical aspects or implications of the story and what's going on. It is more a movie that is all about, you know, the ethics of journalism. What do we show? Where is the line? What is it appropriate? And when do we cross that line? And in that sense, I think this movie succeeded tremendously. Then, at number 19, I have Conclave, and I think Conclave is a great movie with some truly amazing performances, some exceptional dialogue that, in my opinion, might very well be some of the best dialogue I heard in the entire year. Once again, directed by Edward Berger, the cinematography was beautiful, the music was beautiful. In my opinion, the third act heightened everything a bit too much, but, you know, Conclave, still a truly great movie, and it is my number 19 out of the top 24 movies that I watched in 2024. Then, at number 18, I have Inside Out 2. Now, Inside Out 2 is one of the most recent Pixar movies. I have been a Pixar fan for the entirety of my life, so I was excited about this movie. That said, I was somewhat hesitant, simply because I haven't always loved the Pixar sequels that have come out, with the exception of the Toy Story sequels. I love Toy Story 2, I love Toy Story 3, but with those exceptions, I haven't really been the biggest fan of the Pixar sequels, and this movie, fortunately, very much surprised me. I love the concept, I love the idea that we're following the emotions inside this character's head as she grows older and older. I love the fact that as life gets more complex and Riley is thrown into, you know, puberty and, you know, coming of age, the emotions inside her head also get more complex and more nuanced. I thought the new emotions they introduced in this movie were honestly great, super fun, super distinct, super relatable. But my favorite emotion in particular, of course, has to be Maya Hawke's anxiety. I thought that character was incredibly funny, incredibly relatable, insanely well realized. And I think the best example of this is at the end of the movie where we see, you know, an anxiety attack. The way this film depicts an anxiety attack through animation using these characters, I thought was just extremely creative, extremely clever, and I really loved Inside Out 2. Then, moving on, at number 17, I have Memoir of a Snail. Now, Memoir of a Snail is an extremely unusual animated movie. It is not made for children at all. And it also, you know, focuses on some extremely dour and mature source materials. Now, if you guys have watched the previous movie from the director of this film, he previously made Mary and Max, which was also an incredibly depressing and dark animated movie, you know more or less what to expect from Memoir of a Snail. I think Mary and Max is an incredibly poignant piece of cinema, but in my opinion, Memoir of a Snail is somewhat even better. As the title implies, this is a movie where you are hearing a memoir about this woman's life. You know, this woman is telling her life story to the audience. And, you know, this is a woman who, much like the characters in Mary and Max, this is a woman who is a misfit. She is lonely. She is a socially awkward hoarder. And, you know, in this film, she tells us about her life in an extremely stream of consciousness sort of way. There's not really a rhyme of reason of why she brings up the memories that she does when she does. You're just going along for the ride and, you know, trying to get a grasp of what this life was along with her. And in that sense, I thought this movie was extremely tragic and sad. That said, you know, there are some glimmers of hope. There are funny moments. There are silver linings amongst all this tragedy. And that brings me to my next point, which is, that's what I think this movie does best. This movie does an absolutely incredible job at capturing life in its entirety. You know, not just the depressing moments and not just the sad bits that we want to forget, but also the silver linings, the moments of hope, the glimmers of happiness that we can find amongst the chaos of tragedy. So yeah, the Memoir of a Snail really impacted me. Then moving on, at number 16, I have Didi. And Didi is a coming-of-age story set in 2008. Now, this is a movie that really struck a chord with me because I was also, you know, a child in 2008 when this movie takes place. I didn't grow up in the United States. I'm from Colombia. So, of course, I didn't, you know, sympathize completely or I didn't see myself reflected completely in the experiences that this kid was having. But in a lot of it, I was like, yeah, this is hitting. This is hitting the nostalgia. And I think one of the things that I love the most about Didi is just how raw and real the movie feels. It is not sanitized at all. And it allows the characters to truly behave like, you know, young teenagers would behave back in the day. The movie allows them to be awkward. The movie allows them to say things that, in all honesty, are not things that people should say, but people did say them. Young kids did say them back in the early 2000s. So once again, I thought this movie was extremely raw and realistic in its depiction of, you know, youth in the early 2000s. And for that, I very much admired it. I think the best way I could put it is this movie reminded me a lot of mid-90s, the A24 movie directed by Jonah Hill. If you like mid-90s, definitely check this one out. It's going to be very much up your alley. Now, moving on, at number 15, I have The Wild Robot. And The Wild Robot is just an absolutely beautiful DreamWorks animated movie. The animation is, in all honesty, breathtaking. It is absolutely incredible. The music is some of the most beautiful music I heard, you know, in the entire year. And I also think The Wild Robot has an incredibly poignant story. A very poignant story about parenthood and the sacrifices that parents make for their children. And, you know, I'm not a parent. I'm not a father. And even though this movie still very much hit me, I can only begin to imagine how this movie would hit someone who has had the experience of raising a child, of sacrificing part of their life for this other being that they love so very much. This movie just, oh my God, it made me cry. It was an absolutely beautiful, beautiful film. Now, moving on, at number 14, I have Nosferatu. This is, of course, the newest film from Robert Eggers. I am a huge Robert Eggers fan. I think I love pretty much all of his other movies, all of the movies that he has done before Nosferatu, and Nosferatu is not the exception. In my opinion, Nosferatu is, by far, out of the ones that I've seen, I think Nosferatu is by far the greatest adaptation of the Bram Stoker's Dracula original story. It is faithful to the source material. It enhances the source material. And not only that, but, you know, apart from the script, apart from the story, I thought the cinematography was just truly, truly outstanding. The way this movie uses shadows, it uses, you know, depth, it uses light, the way the camera moves in order to transform a close-up into a wide shot out of nowhere was just incredibly masterful. And I would also like to highlight the way this movie crafts its scary moments. There are a couple of jump scares in this film, but they never feel cheap. They never feel like cheap jump scares that are, you know, just there to elicit a reaction and they become annoying. These are extremely well-crafted jump scares that it shows that they were made and they were planned with care. And when you're watching Nosferatu, you just feel like you're in the capable hands of a master who knows what he's doing. And I think the last thing that I would like to highlight about Nosferatu and about all of the other Robert Eggers movies that I've seen is I very much admire the attention to detail that Robert Eggers puts into all of his movies. I mean, when you watch The Witch, which is, you know, truly an incredible piece of cinema, in The Witch, the characters in that movie feel like a Puritan family in 1603. When you watch The Lighthouse, the characters in that movie feels like lighthouse keepers. You know, they feel like actual Wiccans who lived in New England in 1990s. When you watch The Northmen, the characters, the setting, the costumes, everything feels like, you know, actual, you know, Nordic spaces and actual Vikings from the 900s. And that is not the exception with Nosferatu. When you watch this movie, the sets look extremely accurate to what life looked like in the 1800s Germany. And, you know, just to name another example, Count Orlok, you know, Nosferatu himself, the vampire himself, he looks extremely accurate to what early 1800s Transylvanian counts look like. At first, I was a bit, you know, thrown away by the design, by the redesign of Nosferatu. I mean, he has a mustache now and, you know, he's wearing completely different clothes to what Nosferatu has worn in previous versions. But, you know, the more I read about it, the more interviews I watch of Robert Eggers just, yeah, discussing the historical accurateness of the costumes and of everything in this movie, I'm just absolutely blown away. Now, moving on, at number 13, I have a movie that I know is not going to be popular. I know this is not going to be a popular pick with, oh, honestly, probably 90% of every one of you guys who are watching this video right now. But once again, I have to be honest. I have to tell you guys the truth. If not, then what are we doing here? And I know this is not the popular opinion, but my honest thought is I loved Emilia Pérez. I unfortunately very much loved Emilia Pérez. When I watched it at the Vancouver International Film Festival, after watching, you know, dozens of other movies, this film felt like an absolute breath of fresh air. I love how extremely unique it is and how much this movie swings for the fences. It is not every day that you see a movie that is simultaneously a musical, a crime thriller, a romance, an indictment against corruption, a character study, and so much more. And I know some people say that this movie is doing too much at the same time and it ends up not doing anything in particularly well. But for me, it worked. What can I say? Once again, I know this is not a popular take, but I have to be honest, and I actually really loved Emilia Pérez. Now, moving on number 12, I have Better Man, and this is by far one of the most overlooked movies of the year, and I mean, I honestly don't blame them, because I remember when I saw the trailer for this film, my first thought was, who the hell is Robbie Williams? Yes, I had no idea who Robbie Williams is, and I hadn't heard to a single of his songs. And, you know, second of all, when I saw that this was a musical biopic telling the story of Robbie Williams, like a regular musical biopic, with the exception of the fact that he is just a monkey and no one addresses it, everyone just goes along with it, he's just a monkey for the entirety of the movie. I remember before I watched this film, I was like, this is so gimmicky. How can this work? I went to the movie just not expecting much, and I was thoroughly surprised. I came into this film not even knowing who he was, and I left the theater being a fan of Robbie Williams. His laugh story, his music, his energy, his persona, it just, you know, completely magnetized me, I guess I could say. This movie felt like lightning in a bottle. It genuinely, in my opinion, contains some of the most imaginative, creative, and poignant musical sequences that I've ever seen. The Rock the DJ scene, where, you know, it's showing in one shot, or what it seems to be one shot. I'm sure there's some invisible stitching, but in what seems to be one shot, you see Robbie Williams rise in popularity, his rise to the top, and oh my god, that Rock the DJ scene, it just completely blew me away. If you haven't seen the movie, go watch the movie. But if you're not going to watch the movie, at least go on YouTube and watch the Rock DJ sequence. You won't regret it. It is truly some of the best cinema I saw in 2024. But not only that, but also the She's the One scene where, you know, they're telling you the story of Robbie Williams falling in love with this other character. And, you know, they're dancing in this yacht the night they meet, but as their dance number is going on, you see glimpses of the rest of the relationship. And by the end of the musical number, you just feel like you know this relationship just from one song. And oh my god, a truly, truly incredible movie. This is a film with outstanding visual effects, with some truly great performances. And yeah, what can I say? I generally think this is not only a fantastic biopic, this is a fantastic movie. And I couldn't have been more surprised, because once again, I expected nothing from a movie about a musician that I didn't even know who he was, where he's played by a monkey for some reason. I freaking loved it. Now, speaking of surprises, the next movie on this list, I think, is by far the biggest surprise I had in the entirety of 2024. And this movie is, to my shock, and to probably everyone's shock, this movie is Transformers 1. I will start by saying that I have never been a Transformers fan. I kind of tolerated the first Michael Bay Transformer movie, and I kind of liked Bumblebee. But apart from that, every other Transformer movie that I've ever seen, I just absolutely hate it. Even as a kid, even when I was a child and I was just looking for, you know, dumb entertainment and characters hitting each other, even as a kid, I was still so annoyed by these Transformers movies. I remember how disgusted I was when I saw those dogs humping in Dark Side of the Moon. I think that's the name of the second Transformer movie. I remember I hated the demolition bolt testicles, also in Transformers 2. The racist robots. Oh my god. Even like in the fourth or fifth Transformer movie, where like Mark Wahlberg just like stops in the middle of a battle in order to drink a Bud Light. Generally, the Transformers movies have like some of the worst product placement I've ever seen in my entire life. And of course, how could I forget? I generally think like the peak of my baffledness towards the Transformers franchise, when in Transformers 5, they revealed that in the Transformers universe, Adolf Hitler was actually killed by a Transformer. I hate these movies. I truly, truly hate this Transformers movie. So I came into this film. I went to watch Transformers 1, honestly, because a friend invited me. I wasn't expecting anything. I thought I was going to hate it. I just sat down. I was there for the vibes. I was there for the popcorn. I really thought I was going to hate it. And, okay, one thing that I have to explain about me is, you know, even when I think a movie might be bad, even when I think that I might not like a movie, I still like to go watch it. And I still try to go watch it in theaters just so that I can have an opinion and just so that I can have a valid opinion. After all, if I didn't watch it, then, you know, my opinion is completely invalid. And, you know, as you know from the fact that I have a YouTube channel, I am an opinionated person who likes to have an opinion on movies. So I went to watch it. And, you know, sometimes when I go to watch these films that I think are going to be bad, in very few occasions, they surprise me. And Transformers 1 not only surprised me, but it absolutely blew me away. It is by far the best Transformers movie, even though the bar is not very high. And I just think all around, this is a truly exceptional piece of cinema. It is, it is a movie about best of friends becoming the worst of enemies. It is a movie with, and I can't believe I'm saying this about a Transformers movie, it is a movie about deep philosophical ideas. It is a film where you see a thought-provoking clash of ideologies, you know, ideologies on leadership and on how to rule and on how to be a good ruler. Not only that, but this is a movie with some truly amazing action, some breathtaking animation, one of the most badass, like, hands down, one of the most badass third acts I think I've ever seen, or at least I've seen in a very long time. And also, this is a movie that is genuinely funny. Keegan-Michael Key as Bumblebee cracked me up. Not only that, but to my surprise, there's a Key and Peele joke. There's a Key and Peele reference in this film. Like, come on. What? I was so shocked. So yeah, I guess, you know, the best way I could put it is, this is the movie that Mufasa wished it was. You know, where Mufasa failed in showing us friends becoming enemies in a thought-provoking and compelling way, Transformers 1 absolutely excels in doing that. So yeah, I can't believe I'm saying that about a Transformers movie, but I freaking love this film. I would love a sequel. But, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't look like we're going to get a sequel because Transformers 1 unfortunately bombed at the box office, which I don't blame people. I all the other Transformers movies have been so bad that I don't blame them for giving up on the Transformers franchise. But, oh man, was this one great. Now, This was my number 11th out of the top 24 movies that I watched in 2024. Believe it or not, there are 10 other movies that I would put even above Transformers 1 that I love even more than Transformers 1, and I'm going to delve into all of those after this short break. Now, here we go.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
MRG Live presents Don Richard and Spencer Zahn at St. James Hall on March 2nd with support from Myrna. Don Richard is known for her collaborations with Catronata, and her new album features an intimate, soul-bearing orchestral soundscape full of soul, jazz, and confessional lyricism. You can get your tickets now at admitone.com. admitone.com. I wanna be the quiet in a world full of
noise. If I had only one. Attention, all artists, zine makers, writers, musicians, community organizers, activists, anarchists, proles, punks, and weirdos. Are you screaming for your voice to be heard? Do you resist capitalism and colonialism? Are you angry about the current political climate and ready to act up about it? Well, we want you here. The second annual Anarchist Book Fair is now looking for creatives, creators, activists, and organizations who engage in community building, mutual aid, active resistance, skill building, and knowledge sharing to table booths and propose workshops. This is an anarchist space, which means it opposes hierarchies and seeks to amplify unheard voices and build communities of mutual aid and support. First come, first serve. 50% of tables reserved for marginalized voices. Email sponsorship at citr.ca before March 27th. Sponsorship at citr.ca. sponsorship at citr.ca.
Listen, radio is an important means of communicating 3,000 years of habit in terms of diapering of babies.
Well, please tell me more.
Because radio reaches people, including those hard-to-get young people. Radio goes where they go and talks their language, recognizing the importance of contemporary sound.
And the sounds are instantly recognizable as belonging to the in-groups currently on top of the charts.
CITR, 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
It's wild.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you'll enjoy that break. Once again, you guys are watching Take One, and I am going through my top 24 movies of 2024. So far, I've talked about the movies that fall in numbers 24 to 11, but now it is time to jump straight into my top 10 movies of last year. Now, moving on, at number 10, I have Kneecap. Kneecap is an exceptional musical biopic, and it is a musical biopic that tells the story of this Irish hip-hop trio from West Belfast. And this is a movie that I had no idea about. I didn't know about the existence of this movie, and I didn't even know about the existence of this band. Much similarly to Better Man, the Robbie Williams biopic, I had no idea who they were, and I hadn't listened to a single one of their music. That said, I thought this film was absolutely amazing. I thought it was extremely energetic. You know, this is a movie with a very distinct, unique style. It is a movie with some truly insane cinematography where the camera is just wild and does absolutely anything. And not only that, but I generally think this movie has some of the best editing and some of the most editing that I saw in the entire year. I truly think, you know, all of the craft elements behind this film, the production design, the editing, the sound design, the style, the cinematography, it all beautifully and perfectly encapsulates the essence of this band. And now, I guess the next thing that I would like to mention, and one of the things that surprised me the most about this film, is I had no idea until after I watched this movie that the band members in this film are played by themselves. Like, the band members themselves, the band members of Kneecap, play their own characters in this movie. That absolutely blew me away. When I was watching the film, I thought their performances were truly exceptional. It felt like they were genuinely seasoned art actors who had been doing this for a while. So to know that, you know, this is one of their first forays into truly, you know, acting was, in all honesty, shocking. I couldn't state more how impressed I was by their performances. And yes, you know, as I said, I think this is a movie with an extremely clear, well-defined, and extremely unique identity. This is a movie that is extremely irreverent. It is extremely angry. It is extremely unapologetic about what it is, but it does all of those things in the best way possible and in a way that is faithful to the source material, in a way that it is faithful to the band and to what it stands for. This is a movie that can be crass at certain points, but yes, it stands by what it says regardless of what others might think. It has a unique identity, and I couldn't applaud that more. Now, just like Better Man, you know, the monkey biopic that I just talked about, which tells the story of Robbie Williams, another musician that I didn't know who he was, I was really shocked with both Better Man and with Kneecap with just how vulnerable these artists allowed themselves to be and allowed their portrayals to be. As soon as I heard, you know, right before I watched these movies, as soon as I heard that the artists were very much involved in making these films, I generally wasn't expecting much. I was expecting them to some extent, sugarcoat the story and to make themselves look like the good guys of this story, which is what usually happens with biopics when the artist is truly involved, or, you know, the artist's estate is truly involved in the production of a movie. They usually sugarcoat things and make the artist look better than they are. And, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing or that's a good thing, but it is usually what you get. But that is not the case with Kneecap, or with Better Man in that case. In both of these movies, the characters are sometimes depicted as assholes. You know, they're somehow sometimes depicted as not the greatest, most righteous people. And I am honestly thankful that these movies decide to take this approach and that these movies decide to do that, because in doing so, they're portraying their characters not as sanitized caricatures that are not real, but as real living people. You know, these are real living people that do great things and achieve absolute excellence in their fields. But at the same time, they also make mistakes. These are people who can be kind and loving, but can also be assholes every once in a while. These are real humans. So I was very much shocked by how truthful and honest these artists allowed their portrayals to be in these films. So yeah, I couldn't recommend Kneecap enough. I know most of you haven't probably seen the movie because it was an extremely small film that barely got any time in theaters. But if what I'm saying sounds appealing to you, definitely check this one out. Then, moving on, at number 9, I have Anora. This is, of course, the latest movie from director Sean Baker, who has previously directed movies that I genuinely absolutely love. I think Florida Project is exceptional. I think Red Rocket is so great and so overlooked, if I'm being honest. But in my opinion, I genuinely think Anora might very well be his best movie. I love this film. As I mentioned in my video about everything that I watched at the Vancouver International Film Festival, one of the things that I love the most about Anora is its structure and the way it completely reinvents itself two times throughout the movie. You know, The first half of the film is extremely fun and exhilarating. You know, it is electric. You're going with these characters on this ride, and everyone's happy, and everything's fun, and, you know, you're just enjoying life. But then the second act begins with that, you know, home invasion real-time segment, and the movie suddenly becomes, like, one of the most stressful, chaotic films I saw in the entire year. It, as I mentioned in that previous video, it honestly transformed into something that reminded me of a Safdie Brothers movie, you know, Good Time, oh my god, Uncut Gems, I almost blanked on that one. That is the level of chaos that Anora suddenly introduces. And then in the third act, Anora, you know, transforms itself and reinvents itself once again and becomes, in my opinion, very sad and extremely depressing as these characters are suddenly faced with reality. And, you know, they crash against real life and, they come to terms with what's going to happen in the near future. I thought this was an incredibly thought-provoking movie with a very poignant commentary and critique of the American dream. It has some absolutely exceptional performances, not just Mikey Madison, Yuri Borisov, but everyone in the cast is truly insanely good. And in my opinion, something that I didn't mention in my other video where I talked about Anora, I truly think Anora could very well have one of the best final shots in 2024. It is a final shot that just stays with you. Oh my god. And that's one thing about Sean Baker. He knows how to end his movies in a very poignant way. And Anora didn't disappoint. Truly exceptional piece of cinema. Now, moving on. At number 8, I have The Substance. Now, if you've noticed a pattern by now, you might have realized that I tend to prefer, and the movies that I tend to love, are movies that are extremely unique. Movies that are unapologetically themselves, movies that truly have their own style, and, you know, not only that, but movies that are extremely creative while having thought-provoking, philosophical undertones. And The Substance is not an exception to that rule. This is, in my opinion, one of the best body horror movies I've ever seen. Some of the scenes in this film are truly disgustingly incredible in the best way possible. They are insanely over-the-top gross, in the best way possible. This is such an amazing body horror that I have no doubt that, you know, in the future, years ahead, this movie will be reminded as one of the greatest body horror movies ever made, alongside with films such as David Cronenberg's The Fly or The Thing, you know? This was a truly, truly an exceptional movie and a cinematic experience that I will never forget. I remember being in that packed theater with everyone gasping, just covering their eyes, laughing. It was truly a very energetic, electrifying experience. Now, I think this movie has some outstanding performances, you know, not just from Demi Moore, who, you know, she has been getting a lot of the attention in the award circuit and well-deserved. Her performance is amazing. But in my opinion, Margaret Qualley is just as good in this film. Truly, truly insane. And yeah, this is a movie with some insanely imaginative editing, some very creative cinematography, some outstanding sound work. In my opinion, this movie, well, I mean, my number one gives it a run for its money, but this movie could very well have one of the best sound designs I ever saw. I've ever seen, and I saw in the entirety of 2024. And I think the last thing that I want to mention about The Substance is I love the way this movie uses visual storytelling. You know, the way it is able to convey so much and say so much without a single line of dialogue. And I think the moment when that hit me, the moment when I realized that I was in the hands of an expert, that I was in the hands of a person that wouldn't disappoint, was honestly the first two shots of this movie. As soon as The Substance started and we see that first shot of that egg being injected with the substance and, you know, mutating and its yolk dividing and, you know, becoming a separate yolk. Oh my god, as soon as I saw that shot, I was like, oh, okay, we're in for something. And then right after that, we are hit with one of my favorite shots or one of my favorite moments, scenes, sequences in the entire year. And that was, you know, the over-the-top bird's-eye view shot of the Hollywood star, the star in the Walk of Fame, that is celebrating this actress, that is celebrating, you know, Demi Moore's character in the film. Without a single line of dialogue, without spoon-feeding us the message, we see this star being unveiled, everyone celebrating, people taking pictures right next to it, you know, people seeing it in awe, people respecting it, and then we see as days turn into months, as months turn into years, and as years turn into decades, we see the star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, you know, starting to break. We see the pavement starting to crack. We see people starting to stomp over it, disregard it, ignore it. We see people just spilling food over the star, not really remembering who that person was and what that name used to mean. And once again, in one sequence, it tells us everything that we need to know about the protagonist and the journey that they've been through. Oh my god, without even seeing her for most of the time, just by seeing this star in a Walk of Fame, I love The Substance. I couldn't stress it enough. A truly outstanding piece of cinema. I do know, though, this is a very hard body horror movie. If you don't like body horror, if you don't like gross out, shockingly gross movies, you know, skip this one. But if you think you might enjoy it, definitely check it out. Now, moving on, my number 7 in my ranking of, you know, my top 24 movies that I saw in 2024, my number 7 is Ghostlight. Now, this is a movie that I don't think most people have seen or have heard about. This was an extremely small indie movie that premiered at Sundance, you know, very early in 2024. But this movie just completely blew me away. I think the best way I could put it is this movie reminded me a lot of two films. First of all, it reminded me of Mass, which Mass was one of my favorite films of 2021. Truly exceptional. But, and similarly to Mass, just like, you know, when Mass begins, you see these two families just discussing in this basement. They're trying to come to terms. They're trying to talk. But as soon as Mass starts, oh, you know that something happened in between these two families. You know that there's a tragedy in the past that is bringing both of these families together. You don't know exactly what the tragedy is. You don't know exactly what happened, but you can just feel, it is palpable, the tension in between both of them. And throughout the movie, as Mass, you know, as the movie goes through, you slowly start to unpeel the mystery, and they slowly give you more and more information of what happened, of what this tragedy is that is bringing this separate families together. And similarly, here in Ghostlight, it works in a very similar way. When the movie begins, you see this family unit where clearly something has happened. Clearly a tragic event has happened that changed the family dynamics forever. And you don't know what happened, but once again, throughout the movie, you slowly start unpeeling the mystery and you slowly start getting answers as to what happened. You know, so extremely well made. So Mass is one of the movies that it reminds me of, but the second movie that it reminds me of is Sing Sing, and another exceptional movie that is competing for the Oscars this year. And, you know, Sing Sing and Ghostlight are both movies about the power of theater, about the power of acting, the power of dealing with your emotions and with your inner demons through performance and through acting. And I think both of those films, Sing Sing and Ghostlight, are just excel at driving that point. Ghostlight is a movie with some of the best performances I saw in the entire year. The main father and the main daughter in this movie are actually played by real-life father and daughter, by a real-life father and daughter, and I think that makes their chemistry and their dynamic so much more poignant, so much more realistic. I was genuinely shocked by the performances that they were able to achieve in this film. And, you know, the last thing that I would like to say is... No, never mind. I have other stuff that I would like to say. But, you know, the next thing that I would like to mention is I also love the layered narrative in this film. This is a film with some deeper meanings, with some, you know, deeper messages when you look underneath the surface. And I think the best example of this is the play that the characters are acting, you know, Romeo and Juliet, the play that they are performing in this movie. It very much reflects the trauma that they endured, and it parallels what they went through, and it allows them to deal with their inner demons and with their past trauma and tragedies. So, extremely clever. So yeah, this is a very nuanced, subtle, and powerful film. And now, the last thing that I want to mention is the main symbol of the film, the title of the movie. The title is called Ghostlight. Now, I had no idea what a ghostlight was before watching this film, but right after I watched it, I quickly Googled it, and I found out that, you know, a ghostlight is a single bulb that is left burning whenever a theater is dark. So whenever everyone leaves the theater, there's always one bulb that is always burning, and that bulb is known as the ghostlight. And I think that title is beautiful and is extremely meaningful, you know, not only because this is a movie about theater and of course it's related, but I also think it has a very deep symbolic importance. If we see the idea of the ghostlight, the symbol of the ghostlight, as something that is always burning, something that is always there, I think the movie makes a great point for why grief in this film is a ghostlight, you know, grief as a ghostlight. An inextinguishable grief that can't be ignored and must be confronted. But the movie also makes a great point for love being a ghostlight, you know, an unconditional love that is expressed with difficulty but understood with ease. Grief and love are both ghostlights in this movie, are things that will always be there. You just have to deal with them, you just have to confront them, and you just have to find them and know where to look. So yeah, I truly love Ghostlight. An exceptional small indie that I'm very glad I watched. Now, moving on, at number 6, I have truly one of the most unique movies that I saw in the entire year. Like, this is a unique voice. This is from a newer filmmaker that is just getting started, and I can't wait to see what they do next. I am talking, of course, about I Saw the TV Glow. As I mentioned, an extremely unique, deep, thought-provoking movie. This is a movie that is about so much. It feels like a collage not only of influences and references, but it is a collage of thoughts, of ideas, of emotions, and it completely magnetized me once again. This is a movie that you could see it as a movie about nostalgia, you know, a movie about looking back with rose-tinted glasses. You could also say this is a movie about not being comfortable with who you are while still always remembering who you were. This is also a movie that you could very well read it through the lens of Platonic metaphysics. You know, when I was in high school and I was taking philosophy in high school, one of the pieces of philosophy that, you know, stuck with me the most was, you know, the 7th book of the Republic, where Plato describes his allegory of the cave, you know, where he talks about this allegory of all of these prisoners that are living inside a cave, seeing shadows, and that's the only thing they've seen in the entire life because they've always lived in this cave. So they've started to assume that the shadows they see are the real life. But then one of these prisoners is suddenly unchained, the prisoner is able to leave the cave, and the prisoner realizes that there is a whole other real world that is so much more real than the shadows that they thought were reality. When I was in high school and even at university, I wrote many papers about The Matrix being a modern retelling of Plato's allegory of the cave, but I in all honesty, I think you could make similar papers with I Saw the TV Glow and, you know, analyzing through Platonic metaphysics. After all, this is another movie where characters are not really sure if their world is not, or might be an illusion. This is a movie where characters allude to the fact that there might be a more real world beneath or beyond their own. So yeah, extremely thought-provoking. And, you know, not only that, this movie is, of course, also an incredibly poignant, fascinating parable for transitioning and what it's like to transition, you know, what it's like to not feel comfortable in your own skin. So yeah, this is a movie that is so many different things at the same time, and in my opinion, does every single one of them beautifully. The director of this film, Jane Schonbrunn, I generally think they are a filmmaker that I want to keep an eye out. I keep an eye on. They have something to say. They have an extremely unique voice, and I can't wait to see what they do next. Now, before I go into my top 5 movies of 2024, it is time we go into our very last break, and here it is.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there!
Looking for an audio escape to put your mind at ease? Landscapes by Dune is a musical journey through sampling and field recording. From the busy streets of Toronto to BC's picturesque landscapes, the Belgian artist recorded an array of sounds during his travels across Canada. Landscapes will be released on Pop Qatari Records Bandcamp on December 8th and will be available on all streaming platforms on December 15th. For more information, check out at Dune as Dune on Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that break. But now, without further ado, it is time for me to discuss my top five movies of 2024. Now, at number five, I have I'm Still Here. Now, this is a movie that I already talked about when I talked about everything that I watched at last year's Vancouver International Film Festival. So I will talk about, you know, something slightly different. And it is my experience when watching this movie. Coming into this film, I knew that it was set in Brazil. I knew that it was set in the past. And I knew that it was based on a real life story. But coming into this movie, I had no idea and I didn't know who Rubens Paiva was. I had no idea what happened to him, and I had no idea that this movie was set in the early 1970s during Brazil's military dictatorship. Considering that, I didn't really know what to expect. And the first 45 minutes of this movie, I just found so unbelievably nostalgic. I am not Brazilian, but I am Colombian, and I grew up with a very big united family, with a very big united family. And, you know, a lot of what I saw in this film just very much reminded me of some of the best memories of my childhood and some of the best memories I've had of spending time with my family in, you know, in a tropical environment. From the first 45 minutes, I was just in. I was completely intoxicated by this movie, by its vibe, by its atmosphere. And I think it is extremely clever that this movie starts with 45 minutes of just showing you how incredible this people's lives are. And you need that, because then, you know, when that is taken away from them, it means so much more, and it is so much more impactful. Now, in this first 45 minutes, of course, there is a lot of emphasis on pictures and videos. There are constantly characters taking pictures and videos of these great memories, you know, capturing these great memories for later on. And of course, you know, coming into this movie, I did know the title. It is called I'm Still Here. And considering that, I was expecting, okay, one of these characters is probably going to leave. But my assumption was one of these characters is probably going to die. I didn't know who, but I thought one of those characters is going to die. And the whole movie is about grieving. And it's about, you know, I'm still here, even though I'm gone. But then, of course, you know, when Rubens Paiva get kidnapped, I was just, you know, I was completely shocked, and I suddenly realized that this story, you know, the fact that he gets kidnapped, it just lends itself for so much more complex emotions. Because after all, with kidnappings, there is no finality, you know, and that could be a good thing, because, you know, there's still hope that the kidnapped person is still alive somewhere and could potentially come back at some point. But it is also bad, because once again, there is no finality. There is no definitive moment where, you know, you can start grieving. You're just stuck in limbo, perpetually waiting to see if the loved one that left you is truly still here. And the actors in this movie do outstanding work with this moral complexity and this emotional complexity that I just mentioned. In particular, of course, the one and only Fernanda Torres. She is truly, truly outstanding. And at the end of the movie, the point becomes obvious. You know, the movie hits you visually with the thesis, with what it's trying to say, which is, in my opinion, you know, you never know that you're living in the good old days until these days are gone. At the beginning of this movie, everyone was having a truly amazing life. But, they were all taking it for granted. For all of these characters, that was just their regular life. That was just Tuesday. That was just what they were used to. But then after the kidnapping, all of those moments suddenly had so much more meaning as they realized, oh, those were the good old days. Those were, those were some incredible moments, and we didn't realize it until they were over. And of course, that's why the photos and the videos are so much more important and are so meaningful, because then you see the characters looking back at the moments that we saw in the first 45 minutes of the film, and once again, realizing that the good old days have passed them and are behind them. That said, this movie is, in my opinion, not completely sad and tragic. Because yes, even though the good old days are gone, that doesn't mean that more can't be forged. You know, there will be laughter and happy moments that will come. There will be no new core memories that will be forged. And when you live those again, when you experience those new great moments once again, they will seem oh so ordinary. But this time, the characters in this film, this time they will value them. Because now they know what they mean. And they know what it was like to live in the good old days and not even realize it. So yeah, I thought this movie was just, it truly broke me, and it stayed with me for months after I saw it. Truly an exceptional piece of cinema. Couldn't recommend it enough. Now, moving on, at number four, I have Wicked. I talked a lot about Wicked in my most anticipated movies of 2024, and I'll just say that this movie did not disappoint. There's not much that I can say about Wicked that hasn't been said already. This is big-scale maximalist filmmaking at its finest. It has some of the greatest performances I saw in all year. Cynthia Erivo is exceptional, as expected. Her rendition of The Wizard and I and Defying Gravity are just insanely good. And Ariana Grande truly shocked me. I didn't know what to expect from Ariana Grande. I've never been a big Ariana Grande fan, but I was just so shocked by her comedic abilities and her commitment to the role. You know, just the song Popular, when you see her becoming a land shark and just swimming through the floor next to Cynthia Erivo, I'm like, oh my god, you are committed. You know what you're doing, and I love that. The production design in this movie is truly exceptional. The practical sets were breathtaking. They planted 9 million tulips. They built Emerald City. They built Munchkin Land. They built that train that they used to go to Emerald City. The throne room where Oz the Great and Powerful appears. That's practical. It is just so, so insane. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I genuinely think this is an exceptional adaptation. You know, not only because it's great, but in my opinion, Wicked Part 1 is even better than Part 1 of the Wicked Broadway show. Jon M. Chu did some incredible things, and he used the medium of film to do things that the Broadway show never could. It uses establishing shots to show us the scale and the size of this world. It uses close-ups to, you know, really tug at our heartstrings. It uses editing to juxtapose the past with the present and to recontextualize what we're watching. This was an absolutely magical film. I can't wait for Wicked for Good. Now, at number three, I have Challengers. This movie was completely electrifying. The story was incredible. This is a story about a love triangle in between tennis players, and it tells its story in a non-linear way, in a truly exceptional way. Every time that we go back to the past and we see a flashback, we get new info that completely recontextualizes what we're watching. This is a movie about love, about power, about ambition, or about the lack thereof, the lack of ambition. It is directed by Luca Guadagnino, who is a director that I very much admire, of course. He directed Call Me By Your Name, which was one of my favorite movies of 2017. The editing in this film is truly insane. The cinematography is absolutely wild. It feels like Luca Guadagnino is just flexing on us for the entire movie. The third act of this film, in and of itself, is outstanding. You know, there's sweat dripping on the camera. The camera turns into a tennis ball, and you get tennis ball point of view. The camera goes underneath the tennis court at a certain point. Oh my god, I'm like, Luca, what are you doing? And the score, of course. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross did give us one of the best scores of the year. Now, at number two, I have The Brutalist. And this is an absolute monumental piece of art. You know, when people say they don't make them like they used to, this is what they're talking about. This is a movie that is shot on film. It is slow. It has a methodical editing. It has a beautiful orchestral score. It has an insane runtime of 3 hours and 34 minutes. And it even has an intermission. This is generally, in my opinion, one of the greatest American epics. And it deserves to be on the same page as movies such as Once Upon a Time in America, Gone with the Wind, The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, There Will Be Blood. and now The Brutalist. Extremely well deserved. I know that some people have a problem with the second act of this film, but in my opinion, that is truly, truly essential to drive home the criticism that this movie's making about the American dream. You know, the first half is all about optimism. He's optimistic. He believes he's going to be able to achieve his goals. The second half, he's getting slapped in the face. This character is being told, okay, yes, you might be able to achieve your goals, but what are you willing to sacrifice in order to do so? Are you willing to sacrifice your sanity? Are you willing to sacrifice your ethics? Are you willing to sacrifice your soul in order to achieve them? And then the epilogue, in an extremely thought-provoking way, makes you think that maybe all of that was worth it. Maybe that was worth it because at the end of the day, he achieved his goals and that's all that matters. Now, this, like a good piece of art, this movie is food for thought. It truly makes you think. And that ending, you know, in the epilogue, when it is stated that a character literally says, don't let anyone fool you, regardless of what others try to tell you, it is the destination, not the journey, that really matters. You might think that is the thesis of the movie, and that is what the movie is trying to say. But is it? In my opinion, I think, you know, the movie leaves it open-ended, and you could interpret it in, you know, any possible way. Is it worth it to endure humiliation and dehumanization if it leads to achieving your goals? You know, I wish I could discuss this further, but unfortunately, you know, I would be going into spoiler territory. So, you know, if you want to read my thoughts on the ending of The Brutalist, go read my review on Letterboxd. But now, my number one, the very best movie that I saw in the entirety of 2024 is, without a doubt, Dune Part 2. Now, I have two videos talking about Dune Part 2, so I'm not going to waste your time. If you want to hear my thoughts on Dune Part 2, go watch those two videos, but I genuinely think it is a perfect piece of cinema. In my opinion, it should be winning Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It very sadly won't, and I can't believe Denis Villeneuve got snubbed for Best Director again. It's truly insane. Absolutely amazing movie. If you want to hear my thoughts, go watch those videos, but I'm running out of time. Thank you all so much for watching. Goodbye.